What do you get when a bunch of local cartoonists poke fun at Maine? Lots of lobster and moose jokes, for starters. A community of successful cartoonists has tapped into Maine's special brand of humor for inspiration, and they've channeled it into a collection featured in the new book, Lobster Therapy and Moose Pickup Lines. It combines the work of several local Maine artists, all of whom have made careers out of coming up with funny drawings. I'm Cindy Hahn. Today we'll hear from these artists and learn about their unique profession, how they come up with ideas, what it takes to get a cartoon chosen by a place like The New Yorker, and why cartooning is more than just doodling silly pictures. We'll also hear about the business end of cartooning and how they make it work. Maine Calling is next, but first this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Cindy Hahn, and this is Maine Calling. If laughter is the best medicine, then cartoonists are doctors of some sort. Their humorous drawings can give us a chuckle and also shine a light on how we view the world. In the studio with me today are three cartoonists who are going to share a little insight into how they do what they do. Bill Woodman is a native of Bangor who served in the Navy before embarking on a cartooning career in New York. His work has appeared in many major publications, from the Saturday Review to the New Yorker. He's published a collection of his own work, as well as a children's book. John Klausner also calls Maine his home. His cartoons have appeared in the New Yorker, the Wall Street Journal, and Reader's Digest. And Mike Lynch is also with us. His cartoons have appeared in a variety of publications, including Playboy, Reader's Digest, and Mad Magazine. He's curated cartoon gallery shows, and he's a former representative and award winner with the National Cartoonist Society. Mike, John, and David, and Bill as well, have all worked together on the book Lobster Therapy and Moose Pickup Lines, Cartoons from Maine. And we've posted a few of those cartoons from the book on our website and on our Facebook page. As always, we want to hear from you. Did you ever dream of being a cartoonist? Do you have favorite cartoons or comics? Our phone number is 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Mike, I just want to start with a question for you, which is there are different kinds of cartoonists, and I think people think of different kinds when they hear that word. So can you kind of describe what those kinds are and what you do?
When I teach cartoon classes, the first question I ask is, where do you see cartoons? And, you know, you see them all over the T-shirts, cereal boxes. And the thing to remember is there's always somebody behind that. There's somebody who's drawing it. So when people say cartoonist, they might think, oh, you draw SpongeBob or you work for Pixar or maybe you're an editorial cartoonist. Maybe you're the guy that draws Peanuts. But the kind of cartoons we do are what's called single panel or gag cartoons. And I always say it's the cartoon for the 21st century. It takes about 4 or 5 seconds to look at the picture, read the little thing at the bottom, and get it, or in worst case, not get it.
So when we see the most common example would be those New Yorker cartoons that everyone loves so much.
Right? Yeah, the New Yorker cartoons, which go back to 1925 since the beginning of the magazine. But what's kind of lost now is that pretty much every single magazine, certainly post-war, had cartoons in it. Even Life magazine started out as a cartoon magazine before it turned into photographs. So these things, they're still around. They're in major publications now, not so many, but they used to be ubiquitous. But if I can just interrupt right now and just do a shout out to our dear late friend Jeff Pert. Mm-hmm. Jeff is an integral part of the book, and it's due to the kindness of his family that we were able to have some of his cartoons in the book. He's also our cover boy too, which tickles me.
So for anyone who's ever been in a gift shop in Maine and has seen the lobster cartoons of a lobster shouting, Bob, Bob, that is the work of Jeff Pert, who I understand he passed away in 2014.
Yes.
And so his work is featured in the book. It's not a profession that people usually think of going into automatically,
unless
I guess you doodle all the time when you're little. Bill, can you just explain how you came about being a cartoonist?
Yeah, perhaps it's, I guess when I was in the second grade, I was doodling. And I think most kids are doodle when they're in that age. And I just never outgrew it, I guess. And so I'm still doing it. And I enjoy it. And then I realized that once I got to New York, and I realized that you could actually make money by drawing cartoons. So that's got me started. And there used to be a lot of small publications like Army Laughs and Broadway Laughs and things like that. And so the smaller publications led to larger publications like Look Magazine, The New Yorker, of course, and Saturday Evening Post. And it was, I guess, the golden age was just ending when I started.
So were you a starving artist for a period of that
time? Yeah, I think we all went through some of that, yeah.
But you can make a living. I mean, I'm assuming people ask you this. You can actually make a living drawing cartoons, John? Does that work that way?
Yeah, I mean, it's become one of the things that Mike didn't touch on. I feel that there was a separation with the introduction of the internet, like anything else. I mean, prior to the internet, print cartooning was where the outlets were for a lot of cartoons. With the introduction of the internet, there's both been a shrinkage in print markets, but an expansion in other markets. For example, I sell cartoons online off of my website, and I'm selling in countries that I would have never sold it in before. You know, mostly English-speaking countries, of course, but the markets have expanded in that way while they're shrinking in other places.
How does that work when you say sell it off my website? Someone just sees something and they purchase the rights to it? How does it work?
Yeah, yes, exactly. I couldn't put it any better.
And do they go viral?
Sometimes. There's nothing more upsetting than seeing a cartoon that you hope to make money for that it's in somebody else's blog posting or webpage.
But the good side is it's reaching people.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Right. I mean, there's the constant discussion of exposure.
So what was your start into this profession?
Similar to Bill and from what, you know, Mike and I have talked about this, you know, I was always drawing. It was a part of, you know, my childhood. I sold my first cartoon when I was 14 years old, actually, to a magazine. And from there, I was always looking for another cartooning job. Majored in art in college. And then when I got out of college, hit the streets and knocked on doors. I was living in Boston at the time and did a lot of editorial cartooning for papers in the Boston area. Did illustrations, did anything that involved drawing.
And did anyone try to discourage you along the way?
Yeah, the people who wouldn't
who
hire
me.
Exactly. Well, no, actually, my loved ones were very supportive. I question that now, but they were very supportive all the way. So.
Great. And Mike, let's hear your path to being a cartoonist.
Oh, I didn't want to do this. I don't want to. When I was the kid that drew, you know, and you become the kid that drew, that's your identity kind of in high school. And then I stopped. Well, I didn't stop. I kept on in the off hours. But I had a career. I was in education. I was an administrator. And it wasn't until I was in my 30s that I came back to it. And just through a quirk of fate, I met a working artist named George Rhodes, who does kinetic art. And he does those little sculptures with those little billiard balls that go boing, boing, boing. And there's one in Logan Airport. And they're all over the world. And I'm like, oh, you can do this. Okay. And he said, Mike, you know, you're never going to become any good unless you quit your job and really do this. And I thought, oh, I can't do that. That's crazy. But, you know, thanks to my craziness, I did do it. And my work actually did get better. I thought I became a better drawer because I was doing it. But there is no clear path to do what we do, and I think that's the truth. Persistence is everything. I just had a cartoon printed last year that went unpublished for 15 years. So like Sam Gross, the New Yorker cartoonist, always says, when you put your batch together, your batch of cartoons that you send out, always stick in a moldy oldie or something. You never know.
Oh, yeah.
Did
yeah.
you feel like it was still funny after those years and you just thought no one appreciated it until now?
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, we're all people who sit alone in a room.
Uh-huh.
And you have – I mean, it is a bit of madness to sit there by yourself and just have the cockiness to say, well, this is good. And when I first started, I would come up with 30 or 40 ideas every week, whittle it down to maybe 10. And I thought, well, in a couple of years, I'll just do the 10. I don't need to do that. That's never happened. So you go skittering off in the wrong direction.
But don't you show them to your friends and loved ones and get feedback?
I used to, but not anymore.
Just go on an instinct.
But in the beginning, yeah, because I think I did 500 or 600 cartoons in total before I made my first actual sale. And I was going a bit crazy after about 3 months. And I was to the point where I would stop in the street and, you know, show strangers cartoons. Is this funny? I don't know.
There's Cynthia, there's also the element of it always surprises me, and I'm sure these guys too, is that I could show you 10 cartoons and you're going to like one and I'm going to like another one. But you're the mm-hmm. person who's going to buy the cartoon, so my taste will change suddenly.
The humor element is what's interesting. I mean, you all started as artists, and that's what motivated you, but you have to be funny. Were you all funny kids?
Oh, really?
Go, Bill.
I don't think I'm funny. Maybe I am, but sometimes. Sometimes I can be funny. I'm trying to think if I made anybody laugh lately, and I don't think I have. But it's not over yet. You know, happened.
Yeah? Well, and one of the elements is that I guarantee you that the three of us will leave this studio and think of much funnier things to say afterwards. And that's the thing about being a cartoonist. You're creating humor as opposed to being a funny person.
Well, that's true. But I mean, my first year in college in Cleveland, Ohio. I was a member of Berserko, the Berserko Improvisational Theater Ensemble, or BITE. So I actually made money doing improvisational theater with this group that brought me, an 18-year-old, on. I still have no idea how that happened. A friend of mine was auditioning. He said, would you come in and audition with me? I had nothing to lose. I wasn't interested. But so that was really interesting to make money that way. But I have my great grandparents were actually a vaudeville team for 30 years. So there's that kind of crazy blood in the family. So this willingness to kind of make something out of nothing and show it to others, which is a silly thing to do. Why don't you just get a job in a factory where you get a paycheck every Friday? But there's some precedent for it. And it's something that I found that I enjoyed.
Well, both being artistic and being humorous, I guess, requires observing people and observing what's around you and being able to translate that somehow. Is that a big part of it?
Yeah. You want to be able to take behavior and then kind of skew it. I mean, particularly if you're annoyed at something in real life, if you can kind of skew it and twist it a bit and come up with a funny take on it. That puts some fresh insight into it. That would be good.
So take me through that process. Are you just going around all day looking at moments and things that people say and say, aha, that's a good idea? Or do you sit in your room and just brew and think of them?
I was just going to say, on my Instagram, sometimes I'll just hear the wildest things that people say. So I'll just draw it up and throw it up on Instagram. And people are really interested in that. People are saying, oh, would you make a book of that? And I thought, I'd never even... thought it. I was just something I doodled.
Right.
So again, whatever you put out there, you never really know what's going to come back. Is that a winner? Well, maybe.
So about the book, can you explain how this book came about and how you decided to focus on Maine as the theme of the book?
Well, as Mike spoke earlier, we spent a lot of time alone, and so
and it's good to be out.
Yeah, so it's good to be out, which means we see each other. The three of us actually see each other once every couple of weeks for a breakfast or a lunch or a coffee or something, and we are constantly thinking, how do we make money? How do we make money? Where can we sell it? I mean, instead of hi, how are you, it's like, where are you selling? I'm serious. And so we were like, look, we've got all these cartoons sitting around. We've lived in Maine. Let's pitch something to some publishers. And we sent out a package to some publishers, and one of them was very excited about this book.
And who is your audience then? Is it tourists or is it Mainers who get the joke, or who's buying the book?
Yes.
Both. Okay.
Yes.
One and two.
Is it doing well?
All right again, Cindy.
The book came out May 1st, so it's still early in its process. Just based on anecdotal, you know, by us going into bookstores and saying, hey, have you got copies of this book? Many of the bookstores have sold many of the books already. So that's our unscientific response.
So in the book, there are lobsters, moose, bears, black flies. What is it? Is there something about Maine that lends itself to poking fun at itself? Bill, you're a native Mainer.
Yeah, I suppose you could look at it that way. But you probably could say the same thing about any other state, too. So, but Maine has some unique kind of topics. You know, as you just mentioned, moose, for example, can actually be kind of funny looking if you think about it. and there's a lot, you know, lobsters, of course, and lobster rolls and whatever goes with it. And plus, you know, you got hunting and fishing, which is the topics that lend themselves to humorous activities, you know, fishing and...
The weather.
The weather, obviously, and there's plenty more that I'll think of after I leave.
Bill is being very humble. Bill is the greatest bear cartoonist alive, and he has drawn more great bear cartoons than anybody on the planet.
We posted one of those, actually, on our Facebook page, where the bear is a model, and everybody's making carved bears out of that model. But, yes, and your artwork is really artwork. It's you're a watercolor painter.
Yes, I enjoy doing that a lot, especially outdoors, especially in the summertime. I kind of wish the summer's a little bit longer, but you know, what are you going to do? But yes, that's one of the reasons why I came back to Maine, because of the sort of beautiful places there is, I think, anyway.
Yes, so, it is indeed. So we'll just take a quick break right now. When we come back, your comments and questions. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Norris, helping businesses and schools stay safe. Through engineered security, life safety, and emergency communication systems, norrisinc.com. And Maine State Music Theater, presenting Beauty and the Beast, June 27th through July 14th. Tickets at msmt.org.
He was 39 and I was 15. He was black, I was brown. And he was a convicted cop killer. I was the president of Chess Club.
Join us for more True Stories Told Live. This week, stories about self-defense, sled dogs, and death row. That's on the Moth Radio Hour from PRX.
Join us for The Moth tonight at 11 and again Sunday afternoon at 2 o'clock on Maine Public Radio. This July and August, Maine Public is again partnering with Darlings for a summer book drive for young readers 12 and under. Books may be dropped off at Maine Public and Darlings locations. We'll also have two public festivals that will include Maine Public on-air staff reading to children, photo opportunities with the PBS character Daniel Tiger, and Darling's Ice Cream for a Cause truck. The first event will take place in Augusta this Saturday, June 30th, at the Kennebec River Day in Mill Park. For more information, visit mainepublic.org and click on events.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Cindy Hahn. Today on the program, what it takes to be a cartoonist. Joining me today are three cartoonists, John Klossner, Mike Lynch, and Bill Woodman. They've collaborated on the new book, Lobster Therapy and Moose Pickup Lines. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. And joining us on the line now is David Jacobson. He's another local cartoonist who's had his work published in the Bangor Daily News, Down East Magazine, The New Yorker. He's also one of the contributors to Lobster Therapy and Moose Pickup Lines. David, thank you for calling in.
Yeah, thanks, Dave. Thanks, Cindy. Great to be on the show. Thanks.
Right,
good
with
to
your,
hear everybody.
Your friends here.
Hey, David.
Hey, Dave.
Hi, Dave.
Hey, guys.
So you have had a successful career in cartooning, but I understand you also are a glass blower. So are you able to do both at once?
I am, and right now I do the glass blowing full time, and I do some cartooning. I'm kind of like the opposite of these guys. I had started out doing cartooning full time, and then I was fortunate enough to have a staff job in New York at a newspaper. I had a daily cartoon for 18 years, and I always knew I wanted to get back to doing glass blowing, which is what I studied in college. And so for the longest time, my cartooning supported my glass blowing. And then my wife and I moved up to Maine in 2003 with the idea that I could switch over and get back to doing glass blowing full time. And now I am. And, while I was up here, I started doing the cartoons, like you said, for Down East Magazine and for the Bangor Daily News. So now 98% of my time is really spent doing glass. And then I do the an occasional cartoon, mainly for the a dog and a cat magazine out of Canada.
That sounds like a good combo.
It's great, yeah.
With the daily cartoon that you worked on in New York, is it hard to continuously come up with ideas so every single day and you have to keep up the news? Or was it sort of news-oriented?
Yeah, it was extremely difficult. A lot of waking up in the middle of the night, like at 3 a.m., you know, saying, oh, my God, I'm not going to come up with anything today. My ideas came more from everyday life, similar to what these guys do and what are published in The New Yorker, is more of like making fun of us and our lifestyles. So I would peg it to current events just to keep it fresher and give me some more material.
But, so you managed to squeeze, you managed to get something out every day.
Never missed a deadline.
Wow.
I was also at one point syndicated with a separate cartoon for United Media, which was an additional 6 cartoons a week. So I was pulling out 11 a week.
Wow.
But had to get by an editor, approved by an editor. I just couldn't put anything in the paper. It had to get approved. So, yeah, it was really pretty crazy, but also extremely exciting and extremely lucky. I was very, very fortunate.
That's wonderful. And what do you think surprises people the most about the life of a cartoonist that they don't understand?
That it can be incredibly dull.
Really?
Yeah, that's right. It? That's dull? Yeah.
Dave, everybody, talk about the groupies.
Yeah, right, right.
John, no. We're trying to keep that under, you know. You know, we sit by, like Mike said, and Bill and John, you know, you asked if we were funny. We were all funny, but we also love the sitting at a table and drawing and coming up with ideas. It's really not as exciting as you would think. You know, we're not running around laughing 24 hours a day. I mean, when a cartoon makes us laugh, then we know it's a good one. Yeah. That's pretty standard, I think, for cartoonists. You know, if I'm laughing, I'm drawing it.
Wow.
But, It's work. It's a craft. You don't wait for the muse. You're very disciplined. I know these three guys and myself would be drawing every day. It's a discipline. You can't just wait, especially when you're on deadline, or you want to get a packet to the New Yorker every week or Reader's Digest. You have to make sure those cartoons are going to get done and in the mail. So.
Wow,
it's very glamorous. Don't get me wrong; we're extremely lucky. It's a rare ability to be able to do it. But you know, I wish it was all yucks and laughs and chauffeur-driven limousines every day. You know,
that is hard work. Well, thank you, David, for joining us. David Jacobson is a glassblower in Montville, and he's had his cartoons published in a variety of publications. So, one thing that David mentioned was sending off packets to the New Yorker. How does it work that someone gets chosen to have their cartoon in the New Yorker? Do you just continuously try? I mean, is that the holy grail to get it in there?
Is it like the old Carnegie Hall thing, practice?
Right, right.
But is it sort of like he was treating it like it's just a regular thing you do, hoping that you'll hit at some point, right?
Well, when I was living in New York, we'd go to the magazine once a week, usually on a Tuesday. And they had like a little sitting room, waiting room, and we'd all sit there with our little badges and wait for our turn to go inside and speak to the cartoon editor.
Oh.
And we would show the cartoon editor what we have done in the past week or so. And the cartoon editor would either send them right back to you, or he might hold a couple. And then we'd come back the following week, and he'd give me back the two that he held, or he might have bought one. So that's about basic of the whole concept.
But
it's changed a lot since then.
That's evolved, yeah.
I've been away from New York for a while, so
yeah.
Everything changes.
But so. it is harrowing to be sitting there for, you know, the 5 or 10 minutes, and you sit down and good morning and how are you, and then they're looking at what you do.
It's like turning in your homework.
Well, I said at the top of this thing, it takes about 5 seconds to look at those things.
Right.
And you've been slaving away at these nice drawings, these great ideas. Boom, 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 boom. Okay, we're going to
goodbye.
We're going to take this one. You take the other 9.
Wow.
But the nice thing about that market, about New Yorker and about weekly markets, is it's the Metamucil of production because you produce your cartoons. You go, okay, I got these rejects. Where can I find a home?
Yeah.
Wall Street Journal is publishing 6 cartoons a week. There's a couple of women's magazines. This one would be good for that. So it's very – at the end, it's helpful to keep on producing, have at least one regular deadline.
So speaking of editors, looking at your work, in a rare situation where a cartoonist was in the news, Pittsburgh Post-Gazette cartoonist Rob Rogers recently was in the news for basically getting fired for his cartoons, which did not meet up to the editorial director's point of view, I guess.
He had the
anti-Trump cartoons and other things that... that I guess there was a new editorial director who didn't like that, and so
There's a new guy came aboard about 6 months ago. Wrote some very right wing editorials in addition to having a he wanted to essentially lean over Rob physically and say don't draw this. I have a different idea for you to draw, which is not how editorial cartooning works. And I think Rob was very much a gentleman, and Rob certainly had the choice to capitulate and say, you know, I've got a salary here. This is good. I've been here 25 years. But he didn't compromise, and I felt like he really took the high road. He is syndicated, and he's looking over some other offers. I don't know what he'll do, but his profile certainly has risen, and It was great to see his piece in the New York Times, and I would, of course, encourage the New York Times for the first time in its history to please hire Rob as your editorial cartoonist.
Hire Rob.
He is a friend of mine, and whenever I go visit my family in Pittsburgh, we'll have a beer, and he's a heck of a great guy.
So in general, should cartoonists or editorial cartoonists have free rein to express themselves, or are they
that's the way
writer?
It works. That's the way leaning over George Will and saying, George, don't say that. Don't do that.
Well, and also I think they're bringing those people on board for their voice. Uh-huh. An editorial cartoon is such a unique visual element to the paper. And I think the readers are smart enough to understand that this is this person's voice. In this situation, a newspaper seems to be treating the cartoonist as representing the newspaper, in which they didn't want.
We'll go to the phones now. We have Maggie from York Beach calling, I think, with a question somewhat related to this. Hi, Maggie.
Hi. Great show, and I love the way everybody's laughing all the time.
We are funny guys here.
Oh, are you going to say something funny, Maggie? Go ahead.
Okay, do you guys ever draw the line? And this relates to the last thing you were talking about. I mean, satire can be so funny and wonderful and witty and everything else. Do you draw the line between being cartoons being satire or not being sardonic? You know, which I think bothers people sometimes, but I think if you want to be mean-spirited a bit, it's okay.
Do you have an example in mind, Maggie?
Well, I say what you're just writing about Rob. You know, It was somebody could interpret it as being mean-spirited. I thought it was incredibly funny.
Mm-hmm.
But do you personally draw the line between just being funny or, as I said, the difference between being witty and funny and sarcastic and being sardonic?
I don't do body fluid jokes.
Oh.
I mean, that's the easiest way of saying it.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, the maturity of your craft also. I mean, I think, you know, you wouldn't do a booger joke that would make a second grader laugh. As you've done it over the years, you find ways to make your point hopefully more maturely.
Try anyway.
Well, I did draw a booger joke in the the main cartoon book Lobster Therapy.
I think that's the first time we had the word booger on main.
two times in a row there. Sorry.
Twice.
Sorry, Sid. We will not be asked back, everyone. Not be asked back.
Well, thanks for your question, Maggie. That was a good question.
Yeah.
So in terms of for you deciding what you want to do, do you tap into what you've been influenced by? Like, do you have favorite cartoonists of your own or comic strip artists and that helps you with your ideas or inspiration?
Well, I don't think – I think part of the development of our craft is getting away from the people who influenced us. You know, we're not just going to sit down and copy other artists that we've liked, although that's, I believe that's an integral part of the beginning process, you know, of any artist. You do copy somebody
when
at some
you're
point.
Little, yeah.
Yeah, and then as you develop your own voice or find what works for you. And a lot of what works for us is based on responses from others, either from art directors or editors or just readers. You know, people say, hey, I like this, or, you know, that's how you develop your voice. So
yeah, you're always
so,
reacting.
Yeah, it's its own growth pattern.
So who did you like reading or looking at their work when you were younger?
I always joke that all my favorite cartoonists are dead. So I did. I was in love with, you know, in the the post-World War II cartoons, you know, back before television and visual media had taken over our culture, you know, cartoons were a wonderful element for storytelling. The cartoons, they were regular, flowing, like you had to read 2 days in a row, 3 days in a row to follow a storyline. And I myself really enjoy that.
The comic strips in the daily paper.
Yeah, exactly, which is probably the equivalent of graphic novels now, you know, mm-hmm. just following a story. So,
anyone else have influences?
Oh, yeah. I was always intrigued by Charles Adams. He was a great cartoonist, and I actually got to meet him.
Oh.
And, you know, of course, from him, he did the Adams Family and all that came from him. But I just thought his work was just marvelous. And but, of course, as John and Mike say, you have to develop your own individual style or what you would recall to be your own stamp or whatever it is that's unique enough that you can be yourself.
Didn't Charles Adams draw some of your cartoons, Bill?
Yeah, and as a matter of fact, when I first started out, I was submitting ideas to the New Yorker, and they bought a few of the ideas, but they gave them to Adams to illustrate. I don't think they do that anymore, but that was back in the 60s, early 60s. So so anyway, I would say that Adams was one of them. There's been many others who I love, too. Sam Colbein is another one, and most of them are New Yorker cartoonists because they're a little more intelligent than some of the,
Were you the kind of kid who read a lot of comic books?
Oh,
that's
yeah.
a different kind of.
Oh, yeah, as a kid, I used to read comic books all the time, especially those classic comics. I don't know if you remember those. I don't think anybody remembers them anyway. But, yeah, things like Robin Hood, Tale of Two Cities, those kind of stuff, yeah. It was fun reading comic books.
And, before the Marvel superhero stuff.
Going back a bit.
Yeah.
Right.
Mike, any particular influences, favorite cartoonists or comic artists?
A whole lot. I love Percy Crosby, the Skippy comic strip. That was Charles Schulz's favorite strip.
Huh.
And that's been reprinted now, so you can find it. The dirty secret is there aren't that many cartoonists. I mean, there are probably less than 1,000 working full-time, certainly in this country. And, Sam Gross, Sandra Boynton, these are just wonderful people. I happen to know them because when we get together, there aren't that many of us. And I asked them, would you like to say something nice about this book? I'll send you some cartoons. So they did. So the funny thing is I've been so fortunate to meet so many great cartoonists that I loved growing up. I mean, Don Orehek did so many great comics for Cracked Magazine, and I know Don and his family. And cartoonists are the nicest people, I have to say, and if you've listened so far, you can tell. I mean, we're not sitting here saying, oh, these other two guys, they're not so good, but I'm the greatest.
Age,
yeah, yeah
right.
Wait till we're out in the parking lot, Bill.
Well, really, I mean, for so few of you, you're competitors, but you're not. You're all helping each other.
Well, we're making different kinds of sausage.
Okay,
we're making. You know, I mean, the work that Bill and John Dewar, just amazing.
And David.
And David. And Jeff Pert. My goodness. Yeah. Jeff Pert, you can see him from another room away. He's still those vibrant colors, those thick lines, those crazy characters.
They're all over the T-shirts, all over everything in Maine, yeah.
Mike and I, when we are both transplants to the area, although we've both been here close to 20 years now, When Mike came to me one day and said, "Hey, I've found Bill Woodman." Bill Woodman was one of our heroes when we were children. No, actually, Bill was one of our heroes because Bill was a very strong presence in the old National Lampoon and in the New Yorker at that time, and drew some of our favorite cartoons.
And here he is.
Yeah. So this is a very special moment.
All right. Well, we need to take another quick break. We have a word about tomorrow's show. And it's going to be time for our month in review. We'll talk about all the major Maine news of the past month. Email your questions and comments to talk@mainepublic.org. Tweet us or post to our Facebook page. You're listening to Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Evergreen Home Performance, dedicated to helping homeowners qualify for Efficiency Maine Energy Audit and Insulation Rebates. More at evergreenyourhome.com. And Bar Harbor Pride Festival, celebrating its annual festival with 4 days of live music, films, and more, June 28th through July 1st, barharborpride.com.
It's been a busy term for the Supreme Court. Now the fight over a new justice begins.
We will begin our search for a new justice of the United States Supreme Court that will begin immediately.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly. A wrap of Supreme Court decisions and what lies ahead this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered every weekday afternoon from 4 to 6:30 on Maine Public Radio. Stay with us after Maine Calling for World Affairs at 2 o'clock. On today's show, it's a panel discussion about the upcoming July 1st elections in Mexico and what's at stake, from immigration to NAFTA to energy production, and what it all means for U.S.-Mexico relations. That's coming up in about 20 minutes on World Affairs at 2 o'clock on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Cindy Hahn, and you're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, we're talking with some cartoonists about their profession. Joining me are three local cartoonists who have had their work published in many major publications: Mike Lynch, Bill Woodman, and John Klossner. Join our conversation. Give us a call. Our number is 1-800-399-3566. And I'm going to read this email, Facebook post from Carl. It says, "Bill Woodman is also an accomplished watercolor painter. One of his pieces is featured in Paintings of Portland." So, Bill, that is a big element of your work, that even in your cartoons, they're very artistic.
Yeah, sure am. Why? Don't get any better.
He's modest. But that brings up the question of, you know, do you consider yourself an artist first or a humorist first? I mean, how important are the words versus the visuals?
To be a cartoonist, I don't think you have to be a great artist. I think a cartoonist largely depends on the idea and how the idea is expressed. Some people can do it with a squiggly line. Others can do it with a finished drawing. And probably the same thing applies with being an artist, too. You know, these all kinds of different styles and art, too. But where the art is, that's the enigma, I guess. I mean, who knows, you know? It's like,
do you feel like you're done when you do one and you say, okay, this is done? Or do you still feel like you have to keep fiddling with
it? Well, I think that, truly speaking, that it's never done, you know? You look at something a few hours later or a few days or months later and say, oh, I should have did this, I should have done that, or I could do this and whatever. But generally, you have to draw the line eventually if you're going to survive. So
we've been in Bill's studio where Bill has done 50 versions of the same drawing with little, like, a finger moving. I mean, you cannot tell the difference between
them. But there's tests where you say which one of these things is different.
And he'll say, okay, that's the one.
That's an artist. Yeah.
It's a bit obsessive, I think.
How about for you guys, words versus visuals?
Well, it's interesting because a cartoon is such a unique combination of visual and words. And there have been times, I mean, I've done cartoons that if you covered the drawing, they're still a funny cartoon because the words are funny. You know, a couple editors have said that's just a joke, that's comedy. You know, the perfect cartoon, for lack of a better term, is that combination.
Uh-huh.
And but they work both ways. Sometimes it's a funny drawing, sometimes it's funny words.
That's interesting. So we'll go to a call from Agnes in Kittery. Hi, Agnes. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi there.
What did you want to ask these guys?
I read an article recently in the Atlantic about the difficulty that cartoonists are having with portraying our current president, and that they can't quite capture the essence of him, and that sort of finding the fine line between being rude and being funny has been a difficulty. And I was wondering if any of the cartoonists there today have had any sort of problems around that or run into that kind of issue.
It's kind of similar question to the last one. You know, how do you capture that?
Yeah.
And none of you actually draw political cartoons, do you?
Not really.
No, I don't. No, we're mostly a general humor cartoonists, and that would be editorial cartoonists. To address her question, I think it's similar to a lot of commentary surrounding this administration. It's just they have gone places that have never been gone before. So how can you exaggerate that, you know, when it's already an exaggeration?
Interesting. And I've always heard that their cartoonists find certain presidents easier to caricature than others.
Sure.
Right. Depending on, I guess, how exaggerated their nature is.
Yeah.
So, well, thanks, Agnes. Thanks for your call. We'll go to Margaret now. She's calling from Orland. Hi, Margaret. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi. Well, I wanted to put out two cartoons that are my favorites. One is a Maine cartoon. I guess it is. It's on the front of a New Yorker, and I put it up on my wall a while ago, and it's got it faded, and I can't read it very well, so I don't even know the date or who did it, but it's probably one most people know of, and it's a scene by the water, obviously in Maine, and it's at a restaurant, and the patrons are sitting around the table, and there's a tank over there, you know, of the fare for the day, I suppose. Anyway, the patrons at the table are lobsters looking through menus. And in the tank are little people in in wetsuits, you know. And I thought that was lovely.
Sounds like one of yours.
Well, I wondered if it might be one of your guests.
That's along the same lines, right, Maine humor, Bill?
Yeah, it certainly is. Yeah, top shelf. and it sounds something like the Jeff might do. Sounds like one of his cartoons.
Yeah, it might have been one of Jeff Hurt's.
And the other cartoon I have in mind is, actually, it was a cartoon drawn by Dadini, who used to do cartoons for the New Yorker.
Mm-hmm. Right.
He was a friend of my family, and when my mother died, he drew a cartoon of her. She was a very proper lady, and she had sort of an iconic pair of eyeglasses. And in this cartoon, he has her sitting on a rock in the reef down in Carmel Bay, and the wind's blowing through her hair, and she has this long scarf that's drifting, and she looks very, you know, very spiritual, but she has her iconic glasses on, and I thought it really expressed her, the spirit that she wanted to free but never was able to free in the day when women are supposed to be in the home and doing the right thing.
You have a very special piece of art there. Don't give it away.
I sure do.
That's great, Margaret. Thanks for calling in. And that just kind of underscores that a picture is worth 1,000 words, right? I mean, it's hard to describe a cartoon verbally.
I know this is as bad as like a ventriloquist coming on the radio, dancing on the radio.
Now, Mike, I understand, do you teach cartooning? Is there interest in people learning how to do this?
Oh, they're voracious. I teach cartooning in New York and New England. To all ages, kids and adults, and the big change in the last 8 or 10 years is we've gone from about 70% male. It's about 50-50 now. I'm going back to New York in August, and I expect the 10-year-old girls are going to outnumber the 10-year-old boys in this particular class, and they're all fearless at that age. A lot of kids have their own characters. So like John was making the point, these are a whole group of people that can not only write but draw as well. It'd be really exciting, this next generation.
And they're all kids. Is this something adults could learn?
Yeah, I've taught adults as well. I do think it's learnable. I've had long discussions about this. I do think there's a craft aspect, just like someone can teach you to make a chair, you may not have the aptitude to make the best cartoon ever or make the best chair. But, you know, I've been fortunate that I'm so persistent and so dogged about it that a lot of my success has just been producing material, trying to figure out the markets. And the key, because a lot of people ask me, what's the key? How do you become a cartoonist? You sit down and you do the work. Yeah. And that's the hard part to do, because when you close that door and you're by yourself, no one else cares. I mean,
you're on your own.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's easier to do something else than sit in a room and try and come up with stuff out of nothing.
What do people ask you when they find out you're a cartoonist? What's the most common question you get? Are you crazy?
the ones who don't run away. There's a pause.
Right. It either kills the conversation or
they go into, they share their favorites with you. They ask you how you come up with ideas.
Yeah, that's the biggest one.
Yeah.
Where do you get your ideas?
Yeah, where do you get your ideas? Mm-hmm. That's generally two categories. You know, they'll share favorites or where do you get your ideas?
Okay. And animation now is really big.
Yeah.
Is that something that you either ever considered doing or that you feel like is kind of lifting up the whole cartooning world?
I was interested in it, and I used to love Walt Disney's movies and whatever, but I did have a chance to do a little bit for Sesame Street when they first started. I did a little piece for them. It was fun. It was a fun thing to do, but I think now it's changed because of all the computers and what have you. I don't think there's much line drawing going on, maybe, but I'm not that aware of how that medium works.
And how important is that you see the mark of the artist's hand versus digital art in cartooning? Does that make a difference?
Well, I think it does in the sense that to get your own style, like the three of us here, four of us all have different styles, five of us, I should say. And whereas in animation, I don't see the individual really coming out as much as the field that we're in, the gag cartooning field. But I could be wrong.
Animation's a team effort.
Yeah,
you know, we're individuals. Like,
and it's a corporatization of the art form.
Sure.
You know, if someone says we're going to do a Mickey Mouse story, you know, you can't go to Cindy and say, okay, Cindy, will you just draw Mickey Mouse the way you want to?
Yeah.
Right,
exactly.
It has to be identifiable and the right way of looking.
Sure.
Yeah. It's kind of going back, though, I think, with some of the animation now. They're trying to go back to the hand-drawn art because people
heard that,
appreciate it, I guess. But, I see the difference.
But it's an affected look. You know, it's technology now. I also teach, and the vast majority of my kids, I teach at a college level, and these kids are using digital production. There's no pencil touching paper. And that's not there's no judgment there. I mean, they're coming up with wonderful looking stuff. There's these electronic pens that you can make do any brush stroke you want. You know, so I mean, it's personal taste. I mean, we are all old enough that we still love to touch that paper, but there's nothing wrong with doing a great drawing digitally.
And it still comes down to learning to draw. Sitting down and learning to draw, and not, you know, if you can't draw a hand, don't draw your character with sticking his hand in his pants or putting his hands behind him. You have to learn to draw the hand. And the number of art teachers that I had, and this is in public grade school, who didn't draw, who would tell me what to draw but wouldn't draw themselves, always led me to suspect, you can't do this. But it's very hard. It's a hard thing to do because you have to know to tell stories and you have to be able to draw, and now you have to be able to color. And can you scan that? Can you email it? I need it at 300 DPI by Wednesday at 5. There's a lot of knowledge.
Yeah. Technology has changed our world tremendously, like anybody else's.
But cartoons have survived, nevertheless.
People love cartoons.
Why is that? Why do they survive in a nutshell?
Because there's nothing like a better I mean, right now, my cartoons are all over the world. They're on Facebook pages and things like that. And it never bothers me if I come across one of them because the Facebook is our refrigerator now. It really is. And it's such an honor that someone said, oh, I like this. He doesn't have to know who I am. The thing that I don't like is if a corporation takes my image for their corporate site without asking and without paying.
Right. Well, I certainly always send cartoons that I like to everybody I know.
Exactly.
So, yeah.
That's
well, great.
And please keep doing that.
Okay. Uh-huh. Well, great conversation. Thank you all for joining us. Bill, John, Mike. Bill Woodman, John Klossner, Mike Lynch. They're all contributors to the book Lobster Therapy and Moose Pickup Lines, Cartoons from Maine. Roddy Nickpour ran the board today. You can find past editions of Maine Calling as well as helpful links and resources by visiting mainecalling.org. Today's show will be broadcast again tonight at 8. Tomorrow on the program, the stories from June that made the headlines. I'm Cindy Hahn, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.